This is from the Song of Solomon, chapter 5, and it needs a little music with it. I slept, but my heart was awake. A sound, my beloved is knocking. Open to me, my sister, my love, my dove, my perfect one. For my head is wet with dew and my locks with the drops of the night. Well, I put off my garment. How can I put it back on again? I've already cleaned my feet. You want me to get them dirty again? My beloved put his hand to the latch, and my heart was thrilled within me. And I rose to open to my beloved, and my hands dripped with myrrh, and my fingers with liquid myrrh on the handle of the bolt. And I opened to my beloved, but my beloved had turned, and he was gone. And my soul failed within me. And I sought him, but I didn't find him. And I called him, but he didn't answer me. And the watchmen found me as they went about in the city, and they beat me and they bruised me and they took off my veil, those watchmen of the walls. I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, if you find my beloved, tell him I am sick with love. What is your beloved more than others? Most beautiful of women, what is your beloved more than other beloveds that you should ask us to look for him like this? My beloved is ruddy and radiant. He is fairer than 10,000. His head is the finest gold, and his locks are wavy and black as a raven, and his eyes are like doves beside streams of water, bathed in milk, sitting inside of a full pool, and his cheeks are like beds of spices, mounds of sweet swelling herbs, and his lips are lilies. And his arms are like rods of gold set with jewels, and his body is like polished ivory bedecked with sapphires, and his legs are like marble columns set on bases of gold. He is like Lebanon, choice as the cedars. His mouth is most sweet. He is altogether lovely. This is my beloved. This is my friend, O daughters of Jerusalem. Where is your beloved gone, O most beautiful of women? Where has your beloved turned that we can seek him with you? Oh, there he is. My beloved has gone down to the garden. I am my beloved's, and my beloved's is mine. You know, we've been spending a few weeks in the Song of Songs, the Song of Solomon, but just because it's a basically love poems that two young people were writing to each other, and the love that they had and how they had it and where love comes from and how love, like between a young man and a young woman, or an old man and old woman, is how it grows and how you keep it and how you make it healthy and happy and stuff. And the fact that God says that kind of love between people that are married it's a calling beyond your mind of the way God loves you, and it helps you to know it. And so it's been risky, but we've been talking about, but in thinking about the Song of Solomon and love and how love grows and what you have to do and say and the things that they did and said to each other, made me think about love letters and people who were good at writing love letters. The Lewis Carroll, who wrote The Alice in Wonderland, was awesome at it. He wrote a love letter to his wife, May, and he says, "Dearest May, thank you so much indeed for the peaches. They were delicious. Eating one was almost as nice as kissing you. Of course, not quite, I think. If I could give the exact measurement, I would say 3/4 as nice. We are having such a lovely time here. The sand is beautiful, but I wander the beach, and I look for you in vain. And May, and then I say, 'Where is May?' And some stupid boatman says, 'It isn't May. It's September, sir. This does not comfort me. Always your loving, Lewis.'" Wow. Here is one from probably the silver medal winner of all the letters I read, Mark Twain. "Livy, dear, I have already mailed today's letter, but I am so proud of my privilege of writing the dearest girl in all the world whenever I please that I will add a few lines, if only to say I love you, Livy. For I do love you, Livy, as the dew loves the flowers, as the birds love the sunshine, as the waves love the breeze, as mothers love their firstborn, as memory loves old faces, as the yearning tides love the moon, as angels love the pure in heart. Wow. Take my kiss and my benediction and try to be reconciled to the fact that I am yours forever." Here's another one, Livy dear. I am grateful, gratefuler than ever before that you were born and that your love is mine and our two lives are woven and welded together. Out of the depths of my happy heart wells a great tide of love for this priceless treasure that is confided to my lifelong keeping. And if you cannot see these intangible waves as they flow towards you, darling, but in these waves you will hear, as it were, the distant beating of the surf. Wow. Okay, here is the best one of maybe love letter of all time. It was a guy who was actually, he was a lawyer from Rhode Island, and he was in the state, Rhode Island State Congress, and his name was Sullivan Ballou, and he married this girl named Sarah Shumway, and they had two boys, and he was killed in the first battle of Bull Run. But about a week before he was killed, he wrote this letter from Camp Clark, Washington. He actually became famous on the PBS series by Ken Burns on the Civil War. Hit it, Matt. My dear Sarah, the indications are strong that we shall move in a few days, perhaps tomorrow. And lest I should not be able to write again, I feel impelled to write a few lines that may fall under your eye when I shall be no more. Sarah, my love for you is deathless. It seems to bind me with mighty cables that nothing but omnipotence can break. And yet my love of country comes over me like a strong wind and bears me irresistibly on with all of the chains of the battlefield. Memories of the blissful moments I have spent with you come creeping over me, and I feel most gratified to God and to you that I have enjoyed them for so long. And if I do not return, my dear Sarah, never forget how much I love you. And when my last breath escapes me on the battlefield, it will whisper your name. Oh, Sarah, if the dead could come back to this earth and flit unseen around those they have loved, I'll always be near you in the darkest days and in the darkest nights, always, always. And there will be a soft breeze upon your cheek, and it will be my breath. And as the cool air fans your throbbing temple, it will be my spirit passing by. Sarah, do not mourn me dead. Think I am gone, and I wait for thee, for we shall meet again. Wow. Oh, man. He never mailed that letter. It was found when the governor of Rhode Island went to Virginia to collect all the remains of Rhode Island soldiers. They found that in his stuff. She never married, and she was 24 when they got married, and she died in 1917, never married again. I mean, who's going to compete with that? I'm just sorry. It's like, before you ask me, I need you to read a letter from my first husband. It's like, there was a letter written by a guy. The state that sent more soldiers per capita to the Civil War was Iowa. And there was a young man who was engaged to this girl. And he wrote her a letter because he had lost an arm and a leg. And he was telling her that if she wanted to, she should feel free to break their engagement. And she wrote him back and said, as long as you have enough of a body to contain your soul, I will cling to it. Wow. People rocked back then, you know. It was just like, and so you read this stuff, you know, this young couple in the Song of Solomon and the things that they said. And I just kind of asked myself the question, were these guys married or were they just messing around? You know, when you read the book of the song, because they always seem to be sneaking around, you know. And one of the reasons I think that they were sneaking around is that in their relationship, they were a real lover of outdoor sports. And so, you know, in the fields, in the grapevines, under the apple tree. And so I guess you have to protect your privacy if you're going to do that stuff. But although we've all been reading about everything they ever did for the last 3,000 years. But they talk about their house that they have and their gardens and their vineyards. And six times he calls her my bride. So, in fact, chapter 4 is basically their wedding night, I guess. Except it really wasn't It really wasn't like you might think it was, because when back in like biblical days, well, at least this is like in New Testament days, when people got married, it would be like a young man, maybe 13 to 14 to 16, and a girl that he was liking. Sometimes there was a committee involved, including his parents, but they he would sign what he called the Irushin Kiddushin, which is the holy agreement where they would become engaged. And usually it would last for a year, and it was legally binding. I mean, it was just like they were married, except for one thing and everything that leads up to that one thing. But when they would get, their wedding day was only known to him and to his, like, guy, the guys that were his, like, guys, you know, and his friends. Usually that people would, weddings were on Wednesday, and usually they were late in the day, but they would pick the day. And when it came that day, she always had to be ready, just like our Lord said, just always be ready, because you don't know when your bridegroom is coming. And so, and then they would pick a day, and when it was the day, they would dress him all in white, and he would have a multicolored silk sash and a crown on his head, a gold crown, and they would put gold dust in his beard, like whatever beard a 13-year-old can have, but then, and he'd be on a white horse, and they would go, and they would start a parade, like at night. It was a torch parade with all of his friends, and he would be on this white horse, and they would go through the city, and everybody, the word would get out, he's coming, he's coming, he's coming. So all of her friends would go to her house, and they would dress her up in white, and she would put like gold threads in her hair and all the family jewels around her neck, and you know what, this is it. And he would stop at her house, she would get up on the horse, and they would have a parade, like a wedding parade. What happened to wedding parades, everybody? And you know, they would just like wave to us and throw candy and stuff, and everybody's singing their praises. And then they would go to his parents' house, where they would do the most solemn thing, which was the ketubah, which means like the signing of their covenant, of, it's like their vows, where they would sign an agreement that for as long as they lived, they would care for, honor, keep, and please the other person, and that they would never get out of it until they were dead. And they would sign their names to that. And then they had a little parade where all of his friends would have singing songs and escort them to the chupa, which was like their bedroom. And they're all waiting outside the bedroom, like all of his guys. Hopefully they were singing something, or, you know, just waiting for it to happen. And then he would stick his head out and just kind of like, you know, and then it was like, you know, and then they would, you know, come out and, you know, it happened. And, you know, I can just see the older guys going, it'll get better, son. You know, just like, you know, and then they would have like a week of partying and celebrating, and they would be the king and the queen of this party. But none of it, just their life couldn't happen until they made the most important part of it. And it couldn't start until they did the most important thing. And that was when that's the part where they promise and they vow until they're dead that they will be faithful. Fidelity. I swear I will be faithful to you. Whenever we do like premarital counseling, like, you know, Lee and me, and one thing we always tell couples, because the reason, well, we always tell them the reason people get married in Genesis chapter 2, where it says they were naked and not ashamed. That's what people want. They want this one person that in my heart, in my soul, emotionally, spiritually, physically, in every way, I'm just naked and open, intimacy. That's what people want. In order to have it, there are three prerequisites that don't guarantee it, but I guarantee without it, you can't ever achieve it. And they are severance from other people. It's just you two. Permanence and diligence, that you swear to each other. It's like two, we always tell them, it's like two people go into a room and he locks the door, closes it, locks it with a key. He gives it to her and she swallows it. That's what it is. Whatever intimacy I'm going to have in this world is with that person and that person alone, and I'm never getting out of it until one or both is dead. You know, whatever, that's one thing that we want, like couples, when we talk about it, you know, that they say back to us. Because, like, premarital counseling is really, it's kind of like teaching a course in downhill skiing at UT, you know, and it's like, and then you get up over Gatlinburg and you're like, what did he tell us? I don't remember what he told us, you know, but it's like, but the one thing we want them to remember is you're never going to get out of this until one or both is dead. You're committing to this thing. And it just has, there's a place where in chapter 8 of the Song of Solomon, where they say to each other, place me as a seal over your heart, which was seal was like your family seal. It was just kind of like you stomping on wax or whatever or clay. And it just kind of is your name. And it's like, this belongs to me. And it's like they're saying to each other, I own you. You belong to me. And she says to him, and I own you. And you belong to me. And nobody else belongs to me but you. But you belong to me. I remember one couple at their rehearsal dinner, and they were talking about where they met, and they met on a co-ed softball team the first time they ever played together. And she was playing first, and he was playing short, and there was a ground ball, and he threw it to her, and it went past her glove, and it hit her in the mouth, and it split her lip. And then her mother stood up and said, and in our family, we have the policy, when you break it, you buy it, you know, but the reason that it has to be that way, like for the way human intimacy and love, that love, you know, it has to be in the context of like total commitment to you and to you alone and to nobody else but you. It says in chapter 8 of the Song of Solomon, the reason that there has to be a seal of ownership, that you belong to me like nobody else does and I belong to you, is that love, that kind of love is a fire. It's so intense. And if it's going to be in your house, it has to stay in the fireplace, because if it gets out, it'll burn your house down. He says it's like death. It wants all of you. It takes all of you. That kind of love, you can't give it to everybody, and you can't take it from everybody. That kind of love, you can only give it to the person who swears that they will take it from you. And you can only take it from a person that you have sworn to them, I will take it from you, and only from you. I don't know why it's like that, that intimacy only happens in the context of that kind of commitment to each other forever. It's just the way God made it. And I think the reason is because that's the way God is. It's like that's the love that burns in his heart. There's a word in the Old Testament, it's this word that's usually translated jealousy. There's a jealous protection and like a tenacious feeling that I have about this love relationship. It's only used of two people who are married, and it's also used of God and the way he feels about it. And that's just the way love is. And it's just the way God's heart is. I was thinking about like Jesus and, you know, one thing, you know, growing up in Nazareth, and I don't know if people thought it was weird that a young boy turned 13, 14, 15, 16, never had a girlfriend, 20. That was so unusual. 25. A young man who never got married. And you think, wonder why? I mean, I don't know if we're allowed to ask these questions, but why did Jesus never get married? Maybe it just would have been too, you know, I don't know. Mark chapter 1, there's a place where people found out where Jesus was in this house. And thousands of people showed up surrounding this house because they wanted something from him. And, you know, a wife would have like, you could call me first before you bring like 1,000 people over, you know. But there's a, you know, there. And at that point, some people to get to Jesus broke through the roof of their house and just, bam, came right down through the roof. Your friends are getting a little rowdy in my house, you know. That would have been tough. And some people have estimated, biblical scholars, that all of the days of Jesus' time on earth in the New Testament, that are, it's only 31 days are actually talked about. And in those 31 days, Jesus walked 900 miles. That would be hard to keep up with. And one of the things I think is that, like, one of the main reason purposes of God for marriage is to make two people like Jesus. And Jesus was already Jesus. You know, he didn't. But sometimes I think maybe it's just because his eternal heart, that's what he wanted with each one who belonged to him. That intensity of love. That being married, I mean, not everybody who's married ever knows it. Sometimes people get a whiff of it, and some people know it well. But it's an echo of what Jesus wants with you. The intensity, the fire, like the just the death and dying to him and to his love and him dying for you. And, you know, that he wants that with. There was a guy one time, and a friend said he wrote him a postcard. And all the postcard said, because he had been to this conference with a guy named Brennan Manning. And all the postcard said was, "I am the one that Jesus loves." Because Brennan Manning used to always talk about Jesus, and I mean, and John, who wrote the Gospel of John. And if you had asked him, "Who are you?" John, in his book, he was an apostle and a disciple and a fisherman, and he wrote one of the Gospels. But in his Gospel, he doesn't ever call himself by his name. He calls himself the one that Jesus loved, the disciple that Jesus loved. And it's like, really? You're going to call you? Everybody can call themselves that who loves Jesus. I am the one that he loves, and that he wants that with all of us. And I think the longing for that kind of love of someone who will love me and who will love me like and swear they will love me and never stop loving me and be totally committed to loving me like all the time and never stop. It's a dream that lives in every heart. And some people give up on ever finding it from like another, you know, normal human person. We were watching, ever since we've been doing this thing on the Song of Solomon, I've never seen a musical in my life. And the Song of Solomon is basically a musical. It's two people singing songs to each other. So T and I have been watching, I watched a musical this week. It was Les Miserables. We know a lot about operas, and we've seen a lot of them. The good that musicals have more survivors, which is really cool. But in this thing, Les Miserables, there's this girl, and she is a part of this revolutionary movement, and she's in love with this guy named Marius. But he loves this other girl named Cosette. And so she's talking about going through the city at night when everybody goes to sleep, and she tries to imagine that this guy really loves her instead. And she said, "Sometimes I walk alone at night when everybody else is sleeping and I think of him and I'm happy with the company that I keep. The city goes to bed and I live inside my head. On my own, pretending he's beside me, all alone, I walk with him till morning. Without him, I feel his arms around me. And when I lose my way, I close my eyes and he's found me. And I know it's only in my mind that I'm talking to myself and not to him. I love him, but every day I'm learning all of my life. I've only been pretending. Without me, his world will keep on turning. A world that's full of happiness that I have never known. I love him, but only on my own." And I was like, wow. And it's just, there's this thing that people long for it. And sometimes when people get married, they don't find it. A longing for, you know, I think about Joseph and Mary, a young boy. I don't know stuff, but I wonder a lot of things. And I wonder why God, you know, not everybody makes it, but why God's will is that people, that sex and intimacy is only to be lived inside the context of the swearing. and the commitment, and outside of that, and before that, God doesn't want people doing stuff like before they get married. And if, you know, even if we did, we could start over, and that's what's so awesome about Jesus. But I wondered why he didn't want it. And, you know, I think that it's like, you know, a young kid, 13 or 14 years old, and he's engaged to a girl, you know, Mary. And he has longings. They wake him up at night. He's never lived it. He doesn't really know what it will be like. But it's a longing. And it didn't really work out for them. You know, she wound up pregnant. And maybe for everybody, it doesn't really work out to be, you know, at the beginning as awesome as you longed. But there's that thing about longing for something, for a love, and then finding it. And how Jesus, ultimately, it's a love that we long for. And we're never really going to find it until we're with him. But knowing him, we found, in a real sense, the longing of our hearts. Someone who loves me and who's committed to me. And in chapter 5 of the song, this thing happens where she's found the one who loves her and who has sworn and signed it that he will always love her. And then she has this experience at night. And a lot of biblical scholars think that it's a dream. In chapter 3 and in chapter 5, that she has a dream. And the dream is kind of a nightmare. And it's a nightmare that a lot of us have lived, in a sense where she's like, I'm having this dream. She's in her bed. And he's knocking at the door. And he's like, let me in. And she's like, I don't want to get my feet all wet and blah, 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 or dirty and stuff. And maybe she was just messing with him. And then he goes, I'll let you in. And she gets in, and he's gone. And she's like, he's gone. He's gone. He's gone. I thought I had found the one that would love me, and now he's gone. And she runs out into the street, and she's desperate. I have found the love I've been looking for all of my life. And now it's gone. He's gone. And she starts asking authorities, have you seen him? And they beat her. And they stripped her. And it's hard to know whether maybe that's a memory of something that happened. And she thought it would always be this way. And she says to these women, have you seen him? Have you seen the one? And they said, what's so awesome about him? And she describes him. And it's like she's describing a deity. She's like, his head is like gold. His arms are like gold. His legs are like, and they're like, girl, we're not going to be checking him out. I mean, if that's what you want. And he's like, his legs are like marble. There's nobody like him. And I can't find him. And then all of a sudden, she wakes up. There you are. Oh, it was just a bad dream. You know, a lot of us have had that bad dream with finding Jesus. And we found the one who, he accepts us and he loves me even though I'm a mess. And I'm his, and he thinks he's in love with me even though I mess up all the time. And then you go through a time when you think, well, maybe it's not true. Wow, maybe I really have messed up a lot. Maybe he doesn't love me. I feel like I've lost it. Mother Teresa, who was like the most awesome person ever and who loved Jesus so much, and she gave herself so much to loving Jesus and loving the dying of Calcutta and the poorest. But she had periods like this, and they discovered things that she wrote in her journals after she was dead, and she said, he has destroyed everything in me. The only thing that keeps me on the surface is obedience. This is an untold darkness, this loneliness, this longing for him. I long for God. And then I feel he doesn't want me. He's not there. And I felt it sometimes. And then you wake up. Hell, it isn't true. There you are in Hebrews chapter 6, God said when he could swear by nobody else, because there was no one greater than himself, he swore by himself, I'm going to be here for you. I swear by myself that I'm never going to leave you. It was just a bad dream when you feel that he's left you or you've lost him or you're not forgiven. You're just having a bad dream. You just need to read his swearing to you and wake up. Sometimes I think for him, though, even when you read things that God said about the way he felt about his relationship with us, that for him it was the nightmare, you know, to love us and to be faithful to us, to promise fidelity to us. And then we, you know, look for love other places and do stuff that he doesn't want. And he's in the Old Testament, there's places where God says, the reason that I didn't want that is because you're breaking my heart. And the reason that it breaks my heart is because you're fooling around on me. I swear that I love you. And it's like you have somebody else, this thing, this stuff. You know, I was reading this thing about when people find that their mate is being unfaithful to them and they're having like an affair. And when they find out about it, they go through stages. There's stages of emotional stages of shock and disbelief and self-doubt. One woman said, when I found out about it was our friends. It had been going on for 2 years. And I felt so stupid. And then they feel like anger. And then they go through stages of grief until they get to a place of healing. And the things that God says in the Old Testament about us, you know, and what it's like to live with us. And sometimes it's just almost like shock. There's a place in Jeremiah where he says, oh, heavens. He says, has this ever happened before? Be appalled at this. Shudder in horror that my people, they've turned from me. It's almost like God goes through a time of self-questioning where he says, what did you ever fault? Did you ever find with me that you would stray from me? Why do my people say we want to run around and we want to be free from you and we don't want to come to you anymore? And it's just, you know, and then he says, like, just the grief, return to me. And I'm not going to frown on you. Just acknowledge, please return. It's just like God is saying, please, please, please come back to me. And it's just like, wow, there was a place in, there was a prophet that God called to do a really, really, really tough thing where it was a prophet whose name was, and he had a young wife. Her name was Gomer. His name was Hosea, which is a Hebrew form of the Greek name Jesus. And, you know, they were young, married. He was a young prophet, starting out on his little prophet. I don't know what prophets do at the beginning, you know, maybe the weather forecasts or, you know, soccer scores or the stock market or stuff. And, you know, and then he would have to go out on like his prophet tours. And they wound up having 2 kids. And she was stuck at home with the kids. And she was, I don't know, bored. I don't know it's hard to know what happened. But she starts going out with old friends. And before you know it, people are talking about what she's doing. And he's a prophet. He knew, you know. And when they had their 3rd child, he named it Lo Ami, not my people. I don't know. I don't think this is my baby. And then he comes home one day and she says, I'm gone. And he says, I knew it. And she leaves him and she's going out with her old friends and sleeping with them and shacking up and hooking up. And guys are getting sick of her. They get tired of her and they pass her off to somebody else who gets sick of her and passes her off. And she's getting out, running out of friends, running out of money. She's sick. She has STDs. She's, you know, she's nobody wants her anymore. And the only way she could survive is to become a slave and to become somebody's slave. And I don't know, he would even want her then. And this heartbroken young man, and God says to him, I want you to go to the market. There's something I want you to see. And there she was. And they were selling her. And God said to him, buy her and love her. And he was like, do it. And he calls out one shekel. Somebody said, I'll give you two. I'll give you three. I'll give you four. I'll give you 15 shekels of silver and 10 bushels of barley. And he went up to her, and I don't know if she, you know, whether she, when she saw him, fell down to her knees, but I believe he beat her, and he fell down on his knees. And he said, will you come home with me? You know, and she's like, how would you want me? And he's like, I just do. I just love you. I think about Jesus and, you know, the nightmare he lived in a garden and, you know, and all of a sudden finding himself all alone. And he went out into the street and he was beaten and he was stripped. And it was a nightmare that didn't end, because the Apostle Paul said, not with silver and not with barley, but with blood, he was buying us. He was redeeming us. The word redeem means to buy out of the market, to buy out of the slave market. And it's like, how could he want me now? I mean, I'm sick. I'm ugly. I've messed up my life. That's just him. It's just him. It's just his heart. He's just faithful, and he just wants us. And he lived the nightmare so that we won't have to. All we have to do is live the dream of being loved. And it's just like we say to him, why are you so good to me? And it's because you're my girl, Jenny. You know, I saw this surgeon. He said he had to do a facial surgery on a young woman. And she had a tumor in her cheek, and he had to take it out. And he tried not to, but he cut a nerve. And he said her post-operative face, her mouth was twisted in a palsy. It was a twist to the side of her mouth. A tiny twig of facial nerve, one of the muscles to her mouth, had been severed. In order to remove the tumor, I had to cut it. And it gave her mouth a twisted, clownish look. And her young husband was in the room. And he stands on the opposite side of the bed. And together they seem to dwell in evening lamplight. They're isolated from me. They're private. Who are they, I ask myself. He and this clown mouth wife that he has. And I've made her this way. And they gaze at each other greedily and generously. And she speaks and she says, will my mouth always be like this? Yes, I say it will. Because the nerve was cut. She nods and she's silent. And he says, I like it. I think it's kind of cute. And all at once, I know who he is. I understand, and I lower my gaze, because one is not bold in an encounter with a child of the living God. Unmindful of me, he bends to kiss her crooked mouth, and I close to see how he twists his own lips to accommodate hers, to show her that their kiss still works. You know, and I think, what does he want from me after all of that? He wants me to believe in him. He wants me to believe that the nightmare isn't true. He wants me to trust him. And he wants me to be faithful, you know? He wants me to be faithful to him. He wants me in the strength that he provides, as he is faithful and has never been anything other than faithful. He wants me to be faithful to him and to live this thing with all of my heart and to love him with all of my heart, to love him and to honor him and to obey him and to cherish him in sickness and in health, for richer or for poorer, for as long as we shall live.